Colette smacked Carlton's arm. When we hadn't heard from you guys by Monday, we thought you were just having too good a time in Hangzhou without us.
A marvelous time, as you can see,
Rachel said drolly, extending her arms to show off her IV tubes.
I still can't believe you can get an attack of gallstones when you're this young. I thought it only happened to old people, Colette said.
Actually, it can happen to anyone, Nick said. Colette perched on the edge of Rachel's hospital bed and said,
Well, I'm so glad you're back on the mend.
Did you guys fly down on your smaller plane?
Grande? Rachel asked Colette.
Oh, you mean Venti?
No, we didn't,
Colette said, rolling her eyes.
My father has cut off my fleet privileges. Ever since I turned down Richie Young's proposal, my parents have been furious, and they have this idea that they're going to teach me some kind of lesson. Can you believe they put a freeze on my bank account, and my titanium card got revolted? Well, guess what? The joke's on them, because I can survive just fine without their help. You are now looking at the new international brand ambassador for Pret A Couture.
Colette just signed a multi-million-dollar contract with them, Carlton boasted.
Congratulations, how fantastic, Rachel said.
Yes, I patched things up with Virginie de Bassenet, and now she's throwing me a party next week at the Johnny Walker house to make the big announcement. I'll be in all the ads for Pret A Couture next season, and Tim Walker will shoot the campaign. I hope you'll be well enough to make it to the party.
Nick and Rachel remained silent. Hey, this crazy girl here insisted on bringing you more food from Dalesford Organic, but the warden wouldn't let us bring the carts up to this floor, Carlton said.
Well, I'm sure the hospital food must be insipid, Colette remarked.
Actually, you'd be surprised. I had a beef pie in the cafeteria yesterday that was rather good, Nick said.
Thank you so much, Colette. I just started back on solid foods this morning, and I'm craving something sweet, Rachel said. OMG! Let's smuggle up some of the white chocolate-dipped lemon biscuits for you, Colette squealed.
Maybe if I go downstairs with you, they'd let us bring some stuff up, Nick suggested to Carlton. The two of them headed to the lobby. In the elevator, Carlton said, I'm so relieved to see that Rachel's out of the woods. But why are there police all over the place? Nick looked Carlton in the eye.
I'm going to tell you something, but you have to promise it's strictly between us, okay?
Of course.
Nick took a deep breath. Rachel didn't have an attack of gallstones. She was poisoned.
Like food poisoning?
Carlton asked, confused.
No, someone intentionally poisoned her with a toxin.
Carlton stared at Nick in horror.
You must be joking.
I wish I was. She doesn't want to make a big deal out of it, but you know she could have died. Her organs were shutting down one by one, and the doctors were hopelessly trying to figure out what was wrong until we found out she was poisoned.
Unfucking believable.
How did you find out?
We got an anonymous letter.
Carlton gasped.
What? Who would want to poison Rachel?
That's what we're trying to find out. Thanks to my aunt Alex, who knows the chief executive of Hong Kong very well, it's become an official investigation involving both the Hong Kong and Chinese police. The elevator reached the lobby, and Nick pulled Carlton to a quiet corner.
Let me ask you. Honestly, do you think Richie Young is capable of something like this?
Carlton paused for a moment.
Richie?
Why would he have anything to do with this?
You humiliated him in front of all his friends in Paris. Colette made it clear to everyone that she prefers you.
Nick began.
You think he poisoned Rachel to get back at me? Bloody hell! That would make him even sicker than I thought. I'd never forgive myself if that were true.
It's just one theory. We've been trying to come up with anyone who might have the slightest motive. I think the police are going to want to talk to both you and Colette at some point.
Of course,
Carlton said, his brow furrowed in shock.
Do they know what kind of toxin was used?
It's called taquinomide. It's a very hard-to-get pharmaceutical that's normally used to treat people with multiple sclerosis, manufactured only in Israel. They say it's sometimes used by Mossad agents for assassinations.
Carlton's face suddenly went pale.
Bao residence, Shanghai, that same evening. Bao Gaoliang and his wife were standing under the portico of their elegant garden mansion in the French Concession, waving goodbye to departing guests, when Carlton's car came racing up the circular driveway.
My goodness! The Emperor has decided to grace us with his presence. To what do we owe this honor?
Shaoyan said sarcastically, as Carlton walked up the stone steps toward them.
I need to see you both in the library, now, he said through gritted teeth.
Don't speak to your mother in that tone, Gaoliang chastised.
What? You guys kissed and made up?
Carlton said as he stormed into the house.
We had a dinner for the Mongolian ambassador. Unlike you, your father and I still know how to be civil around each other when the occasion warrants it,
Shaoyan said, sinking into the tufted leather sofa and taking off her Zanotti heels with a sigh of relief. Carlton shook his head in disgust.
I don't know how you can sit there in that ball gown of yours, pretending that nothing's wrong when you know very well what you've done.
What are you talking about? Gaoliang asked wearily. Carlton gave his mother a withering look.
Do you want to tell him? Or should I?
I have no idea what you're referring to,
Shaoyan said icily. Carlton turned to his father, his eyes black with anger.
While you've been sitting in this house, hosting a dinner party with your wife, your daughter, your flesh and blood, has been lying in a hospital in Hong Kong.
Rachel's in the hospital? Gaoliang interrupted. You haven't heard? They had to airlift her from Hangzhou to Hong Kong. What happened?
Gaoliang stared at Carlton in alarm.
She was poisoned by someone. She was in the ICU for 3 days and almost died.
Gaoliang's jaw dropped.
Who would poison her?
I don't know. Why don't you ask Mother?
Shaoyan bolted upright on the sofa.
你讲什么屁话?
Mandarin for what the fuck are you saying?
Did you stop taking your medication, Carlton? Is this some hallucination of yours?
I know you were just trying to send her a warning, but you almost killed her.
I don't understand you, Mother.
How could you do something like that?
Carlton said, his eyes brimming with tears. Shaoyan turned to her husband in astonishment.
Can you believe this? Our son is accusing me of being a murderer. How on earth do you think I had any part in this, Carlton?
I know precisely how you did it. Not you, of course, but one of your lackeys. Rachel was poisoned with taquinamide,
which we so conveniently just started manufacturing for Opal Pharmaceuticals of Tel Aviv.
Oh my God,
Shaoyan said in a whisper, while Gaoliang looked stunned.
You don't think I keep up with what's happening at the company?
Well, surprise, surprise.
I do. I know all about that secret deal you made with Opal.
We have so many secret deals with companies all over the world. Yes, Opal outsourced taquinomid to us. But do you actually think I would poison Rachel? Why would I do that?
Carlton looked at his mother accusingly.
Oh, come on. You have been so hell-bent against Rachel since day one. Do I need to spell it out for you?
Gaoliang spoke up, finally fed up with his son's accusations.
Don't be ridiculous, Carlton. She did not poison Rachel. How dare you say such a thing about your own mother?
Dad, you don't know half the things Mother has been telling me. If you could only hear what she said about Rachel.
Your mother may have issues with Rachel, but she would never do anything to harm her.
Carlton started to laugh bitterly. Oh, that's what you think? You don't have a clue what mother is capable of, do you? Of course you don't. You have no idea what she did in...
Carlton!
Xiaoyan said as a warning.
What mother did in London?
What are you talking about?
Gao Liang asked.
The big cover-up in London. All to protect you.
Xiaoyan rushed up to his son and grabbed his shoulders in a panic.
Shut up, Carlton!
No, I won't shut up. I'm sick of shutting up and not talking about it.
Carlton exploded.
Then talk. What happened in London?
Gao Liang demanded.
Please, Carlton, if you know what's best for you, please don't say any more.
Xiaoyan pleaded frantically.
A girl died in my car wreck.
Carlton spat out.
Don't listen to him! He's drunk! He's sick in the head! Xiaoyan screamed as she struggled to put her hands over Carlton's mouth.
What on earth are you talking about? I thought the girl was paralyzed,
Gao Liang said. Carlton shook his mother off and ran to the other side of the room.
There were two girls in the Ferrari with me, Dad. One girl survived, but the other girl died. And Mother had it all covered up. She got Mr. Tin and your banker in Hong Kong to pay everyone off. She wanted you to remain blissfully ignorant about what happened, all to protect your precious position.
She's never allowed me to talk about it. She's never wanted you to know what a fuck-up I am. But I'm admitting it now, Dad. I killed a girl.
Gao Liang stared at both of them in horror, as Xiaoyan sank to the floor sobbing. Carlton continued.
I will never forgive myself, and it will haunt me for the rest of my life. But I'm trying to take responsibility for what I've done, Dad. I can't change the past, but I'm trying to change myself.
Rachel helped me realize all this when we were in Paris, but Mother found out that Rachel knows the secret about my accident, and that's the real reason she wanted her killed.
No, no, that's not true,
Xiaoyan cried.
How do you feel now, Mother?
The big secret is out, and your worst nightmare is coming true. Our family name will be ruined, just like you thought it would. Not by Rachel or by me, but when the police come and haul you off to jail.
Carlton stormed out of the house, leaving his mother on the floor of the library, and his father seated next to her, with his head buried in his hands. Chapter 11. Bukit Brown Cemetery, Singapore. Every year, on the anniversary of their father's death, Shang Su-yi and her brother Alfred would visit the grave where their parents were buried. Su-yi's immediate family and a few close relatives would traditionally gather at Tyersall Park for breakfast before heading to the cemetery. But this year, everyone met at Bukit Brown first. Astrid arrived early, coming straight from dropping Cassian off at Far Eastern Kindergarten, and hardly anyone was around as she strolled through Singapore's oldest cemetery. Since the cemetery had stopped accepting burials in 1970, the forest had grown unchecked around it, making this final resting place of Singapore's founding fathers a lush Edenic nature preserve for some of the rarest plants and wildlife on the island. Astrid loved meandering and admiring the ornate graves that were unlike anywhere else in the world. The larger, more ostentatious Chinese-style tombs were built into the sides of gentle sloping mounds, and some were as big as palace gatehouses, boasting their own tiled courtyards where mourners could gather, while others were decorated with colorful Peranakan tiles and life-size statues depicting Sikh gods, Kuan Yin, or other Chinese deities. Astrid began reading the gravestones, and every now and then she recognized the name of a pioneer Singaporean.
Tan Kim Hock, Ong Sam Leong, Lee Chu Niu, Tan Eng Kiam, Chiu Bun Lei.
They were all here.
At precisely 10 o'clock, a small convoy of cars invaded the quiet of the cemetery. At the front was the 1990s-era Jaguar Van Den Klar, fairing Estrid's mother, Felicity Leong, Sui's eldest child, and her husband, Harry, followed by the small Kia Picanto driven by Estrid's brother, Henry Leong Jr. Henry Leong Jr.'s personal net worth is conservatively estimated at $420 million. Since his father is still very much alive and he has yet to inherit any of his real fortune. For that reason, and because he commutes daily to the Woodlands for his job, Harry drives a very fuel-economical car. His wife, the attorney, Kathleen Carr, herself an heiress to the Carr Chin Key fortune, walks from their consulate-like house on Nassim Road to the bus stop and takes bus 75 to her office at Raffles Place every day. Then came the vintage black and burgundy Daimler, with Sui's younger daughter, Victoria, who rode with Rosemary Sien, Lillian Maytan, and the Bishop of Singapore. A few minutes later, a black Mercedes 600 Pullman with tinted windows pulled up, and before the humongous limousine had come to a full stop, the middle doors flung open and two Gurkha guards jumped out. Alfred Shang, a short portly man in his late 70s with a careful comb-over of grey hair, emerged from the car, squinting in the bright morning light even with his rimless sunglasses on. He helped his older sister Su Yi out of the car, followed by her two ladies' maids in elegant iridescent peacock blue silk dresses. Su Yi was dressed in a cream-colored blouse, a thin saffron-colored cardigan, and light brown trousers. With her round tortoiseshell sunglasses, straw cloche hat, and brown suede gloves, she looked like she was ready for a day of gardening. Su Yi caught sight of Bishop Sibei Sien and muttered angrily to Alfred. Victoria invited that busybody bishop again when I specifically told her not to. Father is going to spin in his grave. After a flurry of quick greetings, the family made their way along one of the more manicured paths, forming a rather stately procession as Sui led the way, walking under an embroidered yellow silk umbrella held by one of the Gurkha guards. The tomb of Shang Lung Ma was on the highest hill, a secluded spot completely encircled by a thicket of trees. The tombstone itself was not particularly monumental compared to some of the others, but the large circular plaza of glazed tiles and the exquisite bas-reliefs depicting a scene from the Romance of the Three Kingdoms on the tomb made it uniquely beautiful. Awaiting them at the grave were several Buddhist monks in dark brown robes. And in front of the plaza, a marquee had been set up with a long banquet table that gleamed with silver and the pale yellow 19th century Wedgwood service that Su Yi always used for al fresco entertaining.
Oh my goodness, are we lunching here?
Lillian Maytan exclaimed, eyeing the fat suckling pig with a cherry in its mouth and the line of uniformed staff from Tyersal Park standing at attention beside the marquee.
Yes, Mother thought it would be nice to eat here for a change, Victoria said.
The family assembled in front of the gravestone, and the Buddhist monks began chanting. After they were finished, the bishop stepped up and said a short prayer for the souls of Shang Lung Ma and his wife Wang Lan Yin, for even though they were never baptized, he hoped that their good deeds and contributions to Singapore would mean that they would not suffer from too much eternal damnation. Victoria nodded approvingly while he prayed, ignoring her mother's dagger-like glare. When the bishop had moved offstage, the Thai ladies' maids handed Su Yi and Alfred small silver buckets of soapy water and toothbrushes, and the two elderly Shang siblings approached the grave and began scrubbing the headstones. Astrid was always deeply moved by this simple gesture of filial piety, as her 90-something-year-old grandmother got on her hands and knees and painstakingly cleaned the tiny crevices in an intricately carved tomb panel. After the cleaning ritual was over, Sui placed a bouquet of her prized dendrobium orchids in front of her father's headstone, while Alfred placed a vase of camellias next to his beloved mother's.
Then each of the family members took turns coming forward and placing offerings of fresh fruit and sweets by the grave. When the cornucopia of food had been laid out like a Caravaggio still life, the Buddhist monks lit joss sticks and said some final prayers. The family then adjourned to lunch underneath the tent. As Alfred Chang passed Henry Leong on the way to the table, he took a folded piece of paper out of his trouser pocket and said,
"Oh, here's that info you wanted. What's this all about? I had to twist a few more arms than I expected."
"I'll explain later. You'll be at Tyersal for Friday night dinner, right?"
"Do I have a choice?" Alfred sniggered.
Harry sat down at the table and scanned the paper quickly. He then put it away and began digging into the first course of chilled mung bean soup.
"Now, Astrid, I heard you were just in Paris. Was it as lovely as always?"
Lillian Maytan asked.
"It was wonderful. The biggest surprise was running into Nicky."
"Nicky? Really? I haven't seen him in ages."
Astrid glanced a few paces down to make sure her grandmother was safely out of earshot.
"Yes, he was there with Rachel, and we had a rather exciting evening together."
"Tell me, what's his new wife like?"
Lillian May asked in a lowered voice.
"You know, I really like Rachel. Even if she wasn't married to Nicky, she's the sort of person I would definitely be friends with. She's quite..."
Just then, Astrid felt a gentle nudge on her shoulder. It was one of Suyi's lady's maids, who whispered,
"Your grandmother wants you to stop talking about Nicholas right now, or leave her table."
After the luncheon, as everyone made their way back to the cars, Harry walked alongside Astrid and asked,
"Do you keep up with that Charlie Wu?"
"I do, from time to time. Why?"
"Uncle Alfred just supplied me with the most intriguing tidbit. You know how you asked the other day if I acquired Michael's first company? I decided to dig deeper, since it did always strike me as odd how he was able to sell that company for so much money."
"Oh, did Charlie lend you a hand?"
"No, Astrid. Charlie was the one who bought the company."
Astrid stopped dead in her tracks. "You're joking, right?"
"Not at all. The real joke is Charlie Wu secretly paying $300 million for a tiny tech startup."
"Dad, are you absolutely sure about this?"
Harry took out the piece of paper and showed it to Astrid. "Listen, this was really tough info to come by. Even our top finance guys turned up nothing but dead ends. So I had to ask Uncle Alfred to help. And you know, he is never wrong. Charlie obviously went to great lengths to hide his ownership in a complex web of shell corporations. But you can see the proof in this document as clear as day. Now, what is he plotting at? That's what I want to know."
Astrid stared at the paper in disbelief. "Dad, do me a favor. Please don't mention a word of this to Michael or anyone else until I find out more."
After everyone had departed, Astrid remained at the cemetery. She sat in her car with the air conditioning on full blast for a few minutes, preparing to leave, but then she turned off the engine and got out. She needed to walk a bit. Her head was spinning, and she desperately needed to make sense of the startling news she had just learned. Why in the world had Charlie bought her husband's company? And why had he never told her? Did Charlie and Michael have some secret agreement all along? Or was there a darker scheme that she couldn't even begin to fathom? She didn't know what to think, but she couldn't help feeling strangely betrayed by Charlie. She had poured out her heart and soul to him, and he had deceived her. Could she ever trust him again? Astrid wandered down an overgrown path into a deeper part of the woods, passing long creepers dangling from the limbs of towering rain trees and old graves covered in moss. Birds cackled loudly in the trees overhead, and small butterflies darted in and out of gigantic ferns. Finally, she could breathe again. She felt totally at ease in these words. They were almost the same as the woods she had spent her childhood playing in at Tyersall Park. At a clearing, where rays of sunlight filtered through the verdant foliage, Astrid came upon a small gravestone nestled by the sprawling roots of a large banyan tree. There was a distinctive sculpture of a cherubic angel crouched on top of the tomb, its huge wings unfurled and arching all the way over its head. A tiny oval sepia-toned portrait of an earnest-looking little boy dressed in a white suit was centered behind glass on the headstone. He would have been around Cassian's age when he died. There was something so tragic and yet beautiful about that gravestone, and Astrid was reminded of the graves at Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. On one of their frequent trips back when they were living in London during their university days, Charlie had shown her the tomb of Abelard and Eloise. When they finally arrived at the grand tomb, they found it strewn with love letters. And Charlie explained. Abelard was a great philosopher in the 12th century, who was hired to teach Eloise, a young noble woman who was the niece of Notre Dame's canon Fulbert. They fell in love and had an affair, which led to Eloise becoming pregnant and the two of them getting married in secret. When Eloise's uncle discovered the affair, he had Abelard castrated and Eloise sent to a nunnery. They could never see each other again. But they sent each other passionate letters for the rest of their lives. Letters that have become among the most famous in history. The bones of the lovers were finally reunited here in 1817. And ever since, lovers from all over the world have been leaving letters on this tomb.
Oh, how romantic, Astrid sighed. Will you promise you'll never stop sending me love letters?
Charlie kissed her hands and declared, I promise I will never stop sending you letters of love, Astrid, until my dying day. As Astrid stood alone in the middle of the forest recalling his words, it was as if she could suddenly hear the trees speaking to her. In the deepest hollows of bark, in the rustling of leaves, she could hear them whisper, He did it out of love. He did it out of love. And suddenly, it all became so clear. Charlie had bought Michael's company to help save her marriage. He had overpaid by hundreds of millions because he wanted Michael to have a fortune of his own, to give him a chance to overcome his feelings of inadequacy. It was an act of pure, unselfish love. Everything Charlie had done 3 years ago began to make sense now, advising her to wait at least a year before agreeing to a divorce, telling her, I have a feeling Michael could have a change of heart. Michael did have a change of heart, but not in the way that anyone could have anticipated. He had transformed into a completely unrecognizable man. The modest, unassuming soldier had become a brash, maniacal billionaire. And he wanted her to become a different type of wife to match him. Astrid realized how much she had struggled to change for Michael and how much she no longer wanted to. What she truly wanted, what she had always wanted but failed to realize until this moment, was someone who loved her just the way she was. Someone like Charlie. Oh, Charlie. In another lifetime, they could have been happy together. If only she hadn't broken his heart the first time. If only she had been stronger and stood up to her parents the first time. If only he wasn't married with two beautiful kids of his own. If only.
Chapter 12. Mar Vista, Los Angeles, California.
When was the last time you saw them? Corinna asked Kitty when they were comfortably seated in the Tesla that had come to fetch them from the airport.
3 weeks ago. I try to spend a week every month here, but honestly, it's become a huge challenge lately because of my daughter's regimen.
So it is true. Bernard and your daughter are here in L.A. for medical treatment? Kitty let out a weary laugh.
I have no idea how that rumor got started. Bernard was here for treatments, but not the kind you're thinking of.
What kind of rare disorder is it? Corinna asked, her eyes widening. Taking a deep breath, Kitty began her story.
It all started right after we got married in Las Vegas. We stayed there for a few days, and one night we went to see the latest Batman film. I didn't realize then how obsessed Bernard was with Batman, how he saw himself as an Asian version of Bruce Wayne. With his obsession for exotic cars and creepy interior design, I should have guessed. So when we got back to Hong Kong, Bernard was fixated on wanting to look like that actor from Batman. He found this top plastic surgeon, who supposedly specialized in making people look like celebrities, this doctor in Seoul. We had long talks about it, and hey, I didn't mind if my husband wanted to look like some handsome actor. I thought it was quite exciting, actually. But then...
My God, they botched the surgery, didn't they? Corinna said, on the edge of her bucket seat.
No, the surgery actually turned out perfect. But the colossal mistake was made by the prep team before the surgery took place. It was a computer mistake. The most advanced plastic surgery in Korea is all computer-aided these days. And the AutoCAD 3D imaging program that was designing Bernard's new face received the wrong information. It was a language issue. The nurse heard the name wrongly from the doctor before the surgery, and she typed the wrong actor's name into the computer. So all the anatomical impressions they made were a mistake, and all implants were fabricated for the wrong face. Bernard came out of the surgery looking nothing like what he intended to.
I have to ask, who was the actor the nurse confused him with? Kitty sighed.
It was supposed to be Christian Bale. But instead, the nurse heard, Kristen Bell.
Corinna's jaw dropped. That perky blonde actress?
Yes. Turns out they had another patient from Hong Kong that was transitioning from male to female. It was an honest mistake.
Is this why Bernard has been hiding from everyone in Asia?
No, I mean, at first yes, but that's not really the reason anymore. Bernard and I came to Los Angeles so he could get corrective plastic surgery. He found a great doctor who has been slowly transforming his face back to normal. But now, the problem goes far beyond his surgery.
What do you mean?
This experience has completely changed Bernard, not just physically but psychologically. You'll understand when you see him.
At this point, they arrived at a small two-story English cottage-style house in Mar Vista, where a little girl and a man were doing yoga in the front yard with a tall blonde instructor. Oh my goodness, is that cute little girl your daughter? Corinna asked, staring at the girl with the long braided hair, executing a perfect downward-facing dog.
Yes, that's Giselle. Here, put on some of this organic hand sanitizer before you meet her.
As soon as the car came to a stop, Giselle broke from her yoga pose and came running toward them.
Did you put on the Dr. Bronner's?
Bernard yelled urgently at Kitty.
Of course,
Kitty yelled back as she hugged her daughter tightly.
My darling, I've missed you so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
We don't want to implant attachment issues, Bernard chastised. And you're supposed to speak to her in Mandarin only. I get English and Cantonese, remember?
Hoy es el día de español, ¿no?
Today is Spanish Day, right? Said in perfect Spanish.
The little Chinese girl said, furrowing her brow.
My goodness, she can speak Spanish so well already. How many languages is she learning?
Corinna inquired.
Just 5 right now. She has a part-time Colombian nanny who only speaks to her in Spanish, and our live-in chef is French,
Kitty replied.
Giselle, this is Auntie Corinna. Can you say hello to Auntie Corinna?
Buenos dias, tia Corinna,
Giselle said sweetly.
We're going to start her on Russian when she turns 3, Bernard said, coming up to greet the ladies.
Bernard, my goodness, it's been much too long, Corinna said, trying not to appear too shocked as she studied his new face.
The man she had seen at so many galas was transformed in a way she could never have possibly imagined. His roundish Cantonese features had been replaced with an angular jawline, but it was incongruously paired with the tiniest bird-like nose. His cheekbones were newly chiseled, but his eyes were strangely elfin and upturned at the corners.
He looks like the love child of Jay Leno and that Hermione girl from the Harry Potter movies, Corinna thought, unable to stop staring at his face.
Come now, it's time for Giselle's cranial sacral session, and then we can have lunch, Bernard said as he shepherded the girl indoors. Corinna was already quite shocked that Bernard Tai, who grew up in huge mansions and on the biggest super yachts, would be living in such modest surroundings. But nothing prepared her for what she saw upon entering the house. The living room had been turned into a kind of clinic, with all sorts of unusual therapeutic contraptions everywhere. And Giselle lay quietly on a professional massage table as her cranial sacral specialist gently stroked her scalp. Next to this was an alcove room that resembled a Scandinavian classroom, with simple blonde wood stools and little tables, hemp fabric cushions on the floor, and a corkboard wall where dozens of children's drawings and finger paintings were pinned up.
This used to be the dining room, but since we always have mealtime in the kitchen, we've turned it into a learning space. Giselle's coding class meets here 3 times a week now. Come, let me show you to your guest room, where you can freshen up before lunch, Bernard said to Corinna.
Corinna tried to do a bit of unpacking in her cramped bedroom. She took out the tin of almond roca candies that she had splurged on and went downstairs, where she found the family was already seated around a wooden farm table on the small patio deck.
I brought you a little present, Giselle, Corinna said.
She handed her the shiny pink tin with the plastic lid, and the 2.5-year-old stared at it in absolute puzzlement.
Wow! Plastic! Put that down now, Giselle!
Bernard gasped in horror.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to tell you. There's no plastic in this house,
Kitty whispered to Corinna. Not a problem. I'll just take the candies out for her, and you'll never see the container again, Corinna said calmly. Bernard gave Corinna a withering look.
Giselle is on a sugar-free, gluten-free, organic farm-to-table paleo diet.
I'm terribly sorry. I had no idea. Seeing the look on Corinna's face, Bernard softened a little.
I'm sorry. I don't think guests, especially those visiting from Asia, are prepared for our lifestyle. But I hope you will appreciate the conscious, nourishing food we consume in this house. We have our own farm up in Topanga, where we grow all our produce. Here, try some of this fennel-stuffed acorn squash. We just harvested it yesterday. Giselle plucked the fennel with her own hands, didn't you, Giselle?
Solo comemos lo que cultivamos.
Spanish for, we only eat what we grow. Giselle chirped as she began chewing carefully on her tiny slices of medium-rare grass-fed and finished filet mignon.
I guess you probably won't be drinking the Johnny Walker Black Label I brought for you, Corinna remarked.
I honor your gesture, but I only drink reverse osmosis water these days, Bernard said.
I honor your gesture? My God, look what happens to Hong Kong men when they move to California,
Corinna thought in horror. After Corinna had politely swallowed down the blandest meal of her entire life, she stood in the foyer, watching as Bernard helped Giselle put on her Tom's sneakers and her little hem-sun hat.
Kitty pleaded with Bernard.
We just arrived. Can't Giselle skip one session today and be with us? I want to take her to buy some cute clothes at Fred Siegel.
You're not buying her any more clothes from that temple of materialism. The last time you got her those frilly pink princess dresses, we ended up donating all of it to Union Rescue Mission. I really don't want her to be wearing clothes that reinforce gender stereotypes and fairy tale narratives.
Okay then. Can we just take her to the beach or something? The beach is still allowed, right? Isn't Fan gluten-free or whatever?
Bernard took Kitty around the corner and said in a hushed tone,
I don't think you really understand how much Giselle needs these bi-weekly mindfulness sessions in the sensory deprivation float tank. Her Reiki practitioner tells me that she still struggles with retained trauma and anxiety related to her passage through the birth canal.
Are you kidding me? In case you don't remember, I was there when she was born, Bernard. The real trauma was how she murdered my birth canal because you wouldn't let me have an epidural.
Shh! Do you want to add to her repressed guilt? Bernard said in hushed whisper. Anyway, we'll be back by 6. Her float session in Venice Beach only lasts 45 minutes, and then she has an hour of undirected play with her real-world immersion friends in Compton.
So why would that take 5 hours?
Bernard gave Kitty an exasperated look. Traffic, of course.
Do you know how many times I have to get on the 405?
After saying adios to Giselle as she was being carefully strapped into the custom-designed car seat in Bernard's Tesla, Kitty and Corinna sat down to talk.
I understand now why you said I had to see this with my own eyes.
When did things get this bad? Corinna asked.
Kitty looked at Corinna sadly.
The problem began when Bernard started getting his corrective surgeries in L.A. He would spend a great deal of time at Dr. Goldberg's clinic, and he became friends with some of the patients in the waiting room. Mainly these super competitive young West Side mothers. One of them invited him to a weekend retreat in Sedona, and that was all it took. He came back to Singapore a changed person, declaring that he wanted to stop all the surgeries and embrace his new face. He talked about his terrible childhood and how he had a father who ignored him and just threw money in his direction, and a mother who was too obsessed with her church to care. He wanted to undo all the generations of damage by becoming an enlightened, conscious parent. The first year after Giselle was born was the worst. Bernard moved us to Los Angeles when Giselle was just 2 months old, claiming that Singapore was toxic for her, that his parents were toxic for her. Here I was totally isolated, with Bernard hovering over us every second of the day, policing every single thing I did. Nothing I ever did was right. I was always exposing the baby to something. I mean, the only thing I was exposing her to were my tits. We went to about 50 different specialists a week for every little problem. The last straw was when he redesigned the master bedroom to suit Giselle's sleep patterns. I couldn't sleep in there with all those strange glowing LED lights, the overpurified air, and the Mozart playing in her crib throughout the night. That's when I started coming back to Hong Kong every month. I couldn't take it anymore. I mean, just look at how we live.
I was very surprised when we pulled up to this house, Corinna said.
We moved out of our mansion in Bel Air because Bernard wants Giselle to experience real-world preparedness. And he thinks that by living in this lower-income zip code, she'll have a better chance of getting into Harvard.
Does Bernard ever ask you what you want for your daughter?
I have no say in any of this, because apparently I'm too stupid to understand anything. You know, I actually think Bernard prefers it when I'm in Asia. I think he's afraid I will somehow make this child more stupid. He doesn't even care if I exist anymore. It's all about his precious daughter, 24 hours a day.
Corinna looked at Kitty sympathetically.
Take it from me, speaking not as your social consultant, but from one mother to another.
If you really want your daughter to grow up normal, if you ever want her to take her rightful place in Asian society, you have to put a stop to all this.
I know. I have been working on a plan, Kitty said softly.
I'm glad to hear that.
Because if Dato Tai To Liu could see how his only granddaughter was being raised, he would be spinning in his grave. This little girl should have a bedroom in Queen Astrid Park, or Deepwater Bay, that's bigger than this whole house. Not sleeping with her parents every night, Corinna declared, her voice quivering with conviction.
Amen.
This little girl needs to be raised properly, by a team of sensible Cantonese nannies, not interfering parents, Corinna pounded on the table.
You got that right.
This little girl should be dressed in the prettiest clothes from Marie Chantal and taken to the Mandarin for afternoon tea and bright pink macaroons every week.
Fuck yeah!
Kitty roared.
Chapter 13 Triumph Towers, The Peak, Hong Kong. Nick and Rachel sat beside each other on deck chairs on the balcony, holding hands as they gazed at the magnificent view. Eddie's penthouse apartment was like a falcon's lair high up on the peak, and below them sprawled the city's dramatic skyscrapers, followed almost too startlingly soon by the sparkling blue waters of Victoria Harbor. "This ain't half bad," Nick commented, enjoying the cool breeze blowing against his sun-warmed skin.
"Definitely ain't bad," Rachel said. It had been 2 days since she was discharged from the hospital, and she was relishing every moment outdoors. "You know, when Eddie first insisted that we stay with him since Fiona and the kids were away, I got a bit scared. But this has turned out to be such a treat." He wasn't kidding when he said that staying with him would be like staying at Villa d'Este. As if on cue, Larnie, one of the domestic helpers, came onto the balcony with two tall tumblers of Arnold Palmer's, complete with oversized ice cubes and paper umbrellas.
"Oh my God, Larnie, you shouldn't have," Rachel said.
"Sir said you need to drink more liquids and get well," Larnie said with a gracious smile. "You know, I never thought I'd ever say this, but I could get used to this. Larnie is just amazing. Do you know what she tried to do yesterday when I went to meet Carlton for lunch? She insisted on coming downstairs to the driveway with me, where Eddie's chauffeur was waiting. Then she opens the car door, and after I got in, she suddenly leaned into the car, reached over me, and put my seatbelt on for me."
"Oh yeah, the seatbelt thing. I guess you've never had that done for you before," Nick said nonchalantly.
"Jesus. For a split second, I thought she was trying to make a pass at me. I was so shocked. I said, 'Larnie, do you do this for Eddie and Fiona too?' She said, 'Yes, ma'am. We do it for the whole family.
Your cousins are so pampered, they can't even put their own seatbelts on,'" Rachel said in mock outrage. "Welcome to Hong Kong," Nick quipped. Rachel's cell phone rang and she picked it up.
"Oh, hello, Father. Yes, yes, thank you. I feel a million times better. You'll be in Hong Kong today?" "Oh, definitely. Around 5? Yes, we're free." "Okay then. Safe travels."
Rachel put down the phone and looked at Nick.
"My dad's coming to Hong Kong today, and he's wondering if we can meet him."
"How do you feel about that?" Nick asked. Over the past few days, Carlton had shared with them everything that had happened when he had rushed back to Shanghai to confront his parents, and there had been nothing but silence from the Bows since then.
"I would like to see him, but it's going to be rather awkward, isn't it?" Rachel said, her face clouding over a bit.
"Well, I'm sure he feels even more awkward than you do. I mean, his wife is one of the prime suspects in your poisoning. But at least he's making an overture to come and see you." Rachel shook her head sadly.
"God, this is all so fucked up. Why do things always get fucked up when we come to Asia? Don't answer that."
"Would it make you feel more comfortable if he just came over here? I'm sure Eddie would relish the opportunity to show off his Biedermeier furniture or his humidity-controlled shoe closet."
"Sweet Jesus, that shoe closet. Did you notice that all his shoes were arranged alphabetically according to brand?"
"I sure did. and you think I'm obsessive with my shoes.
I will never say anything about your weird OCD habits again, not after meeting Edison Ching.
At 4:45, Eddie was rushing around his apartment like a madman, yelling at his maids.
Lonnie, that's the wrong one. I said Bebel Gilberto, not Astrid Gilberto, Eddie screamed at the top of his lungs. I don't want the girl from fucking Ipanema to be playing when Bao Gaoliang arrives. He's one of my most important clients. I want track 2 of Tanto Tempo.
Sorry, sir,
Lani called from the other room as she nervously tried to find the song on the Lin music system. She scarcely knew how the damn thing worked, and it was even harder to use the remote with the cotton gloves that Mr. Ching made her wear whenever she came near his precious stereo, which she kept harping was worth more than her entire village in Maguindanao. Eddie stormed into the kitchen, where the two Chinese maids were sitting by the small television watching Fei Cheng Wu Rao,
an immensely popular Chinese dating game show known in English as If You Are the One. A national uproar occurred after a poor suitor asked a female contestant whether she would ride a bicycle with him on a date, and she famously replied, I would rather cry in a BMW than smile on a bicycle.
They jumped up from their bar stools when he entered. Li Jing, is the caviar ready? He asked in Mandarin.
Yes, Mr. Ching.
Let me see it.
Li Jing opened the Sub-Zero fridge and proudly took out the sterling silver caviar server that filled up an entire shelf.
No, no, no! You're not supposed to refrigerate the whole thing. Only the caviar gets refrigerated. I don't want the whole damn caviar tray to be sweating like a Cambodian whore when it comes out of the fridge. Now wipe it dry and leave it out.
Right when our very important politician guest arrives, you put the ice in here, see? And then you lay the glass caviar bowl over it, like this, see? And make sure you use crushed ice from the fridge, not the cubed ice from the ice machine, okay?
These maids are useless, absolutely useless, Eddie lamented to himself as he walked back to his dressing room.
It didn't help that his maids never seemed to renew their contracts after the first year. He had tried to steal away some of his ama's impeccably trained staff while he was in Singapore, but those servants were more loyal than the Nazis. Eddie checked for lint on his herringbone jacket for the 10th time in his gilt Viennese secession mirror. He had paired it with his tight D-squared jeans, thinking it made him look more casual. The doorbell suddenly chimed. Fucky fuck, Bao Gaoliang was early.
Larny, cue the music. Charity, turn on the accent lights. And Charity, you're having a better hair day. You answer the door,
Eddie yelled as he rushed into the formal living room. Nick looked on in amazement as his cousin began doing karate chops on all the tasseled throw pillows, frantically trying to create the perfect fluffed-up look. Rachel, meanwhile, went to the front door.
I'll get it, Charity.
Nicky? You really need to train your wife to let the maids do what they're supposed to do, Eddie said to his cousin, sotto voce.
I wouldn't dream of trying to change her, Nick responded.
Hiya. This is what happens when you go and live in America, Eddie said disparagingly.
Rachel opened the door, and standing in front of her was her father, looking like he'd aged 10 years. His hair wasn't as meticulously combed as it normally was, and there were heavy bags under his eyes. He reached out and hugged her tightly, and Rachel knew at that moment that there was nothing to feel uncomfortable about around him. They entered the formal living room, arm in arm.
Bao Buzang, such an honor to have you in my home, Eddie said cordially.
Thank you so much for inviting me over on such short notice, Gaoliang said to Eddie, before turning back to Rachel with a tender look. I am so relieved to see you looking so well. I'm very sorry that this trip has turned out so badly for you. It was truly not what I had intended when I invited you to come to China.
I'm not just talking about your, incident. I'm talking about myself and all the complications that have prevented me from spending more time with you.
That's okay, Father. I have no regrets about this trip. I've enjoyed getting to know Carlton.
I know he feels the same as well. By the way, I really must thank you for what you did for Carlton in Paris.
It was nothing, Rachel said modestly.
Which brings me to what I'm really here to talk about. Listen, I realize what a strange situation this must be for both of you. I've had many meetings over the past few days with the Commissioner of Police in Hangzhou, and I just came from meeting his counterpart, Commander Kwok, in Hong Kong. Now, I believe with all my heart that my wife has nothing to do with your poisoning. I don't think it's any surprise to you at this point that Xiao Yan has been harboring some issues around your visit, and I can only blame myself for that. I handled things badly with her. However, she's just not the sort of person who would ever harm a soul. Rachel nodded diplomatically. Gao Liang let out a sigh. I'm going to do everything in my power to help bring whoever was responsible for this terrible crime to justice. I know that the Beijing police have Richie Yang under 24-hour surveillance now, and the entire city of Hangzhou has been turned inside out with this investigation. I have every confidence that the police are getting closer to the truth with every hour that passes. Everyone else remained silent, unsure of what to say after Gao Liang's monologue, and Li Jing chose this moment to enter the living room, pushing a gleaming silver cart with the caviar. Eddie noticed in annoyance that the bottom was filled with ice cubes and not crushed ice as he had specifically requested. Now the glass bowl set on the cubes at a slight angle, and he tried not to be distracted by it. Charity followed along with a just-opened bottle of Krug Clos d'Ambonnay and 4 champagne flutes. Fucky fuck. He told the mates to get out the vintage Vanini glasses, not the everyday Baccarat.
Some caviar and champagne, Eddie said, trying to lighten the mood, all the while shooting daggers at Charity, who wondered what he was so upset about.
Did she bring the champagne in too early?
He did say to bring it in 8 minutes after the important guest arrived, and she had timed it exactly on the grandfather clock.
Sir kept glaring at the champagne flutes. Oh shit, she'd used the wrong glasses.
Rachel and Nick helped themselves to some caviar and champagne, but when Gao Liang was offered a glass, he shook his head politely.
No champagne? Bao Bu Zhang?
Eddie said, rather disappointed. He would only have served Dom had it been just Nick and Rachel.
No, but I wouldn't mind a glass of hot water.
These mainlanders and their hot water.
Charity? Could you see to it that Mr. Bao gets a glass of hot water at once?
Gao Liang gazed intently at Nick and Rachel. I want you both to know that Xiao Yan has cooperated 100% with the investigators. She has submitted herself to countless hours of questioning, and she's even handed over all the surveillance videos in our plant in Shenzhen, where the drug is manufactured, so that the police can analyze everything.
Thank you for making this trip to tell me all this, Father. I know how difficult this must be for you, Rachel said.
My goodness, it's nothing compared to what you had to go through.
Charity entered the living room, bearing a tray with a carafe of boiling hot water and one of the antique Vanini flutes.
She set the tray down next to Bao Gao Liang, and before Eddie could fully process what was happening, she began to pour the boiling hot water into the 80-year-old Venetian glassware. A high-pitched cracking sound could be heard as the glass began to crack down its side.
No!
Eddie suddenly screamed, leaping off the sofa and knocking over the caviar server. A million tiny blackfish eggs went flying across the faded antique Sèvres carpet, and as the other maids ran in to see what the commotion was, Eddie looked down in panic and began to pant.
Don't move!
This rug cost me 950,000 euros at auction. Nobody move.
Rachel turned to Larnie and said calmly,
Do you have a dustbuster?
After the caviar incident had been resolved safely with